The Migration Policy Institute holds a discussion on proposals to reform the immigration removal adjudication system. The discussion, held at MPI on May 25, 2010, was moderated by MPI Vice President Donald Kerwin and focused in part on the release of a recent exhaustive report by the American Bar Association's Commission on Immigration on this topic. Here's Donald.
The topic today is the ABA report on reform of the removal adjudication system, starting with referrals of cases to the immigration court system and through the federal courts of appeals. Let me start by making some introductions and laying the groundwork for today's discussion, and then we'll turn it over to the panelists. And we're going to try to leave about 45 minutes at the end for discussion and dialogue and questions. First, it's a great honor to my immediate left here to have Judge Robert Katzmann here with us today. President Clinton appointed Judge Katzmann to the Second Circuit Court of Appeals in March of 1999, and the Senate confirmed him, and maybe he can tell us about that process. It's so much in the news now. Quickly thereafter, in July of 1999. At the time, he was the Walsh Professor of Government, Professor of Law, and Professor of Public Policy at Georgetown University. He was also a fellow in the government studies programs at Brookings and president of the Governance Institute. You know, but for all of his accomplishments, Judge Katzmann is known in our circles for galvanizing a national conversation on the shortage of affordable and quality legal services for low-income immigrants. And he took on this cause in a formal way in a 2007 lecture to the New York Bar Association, the Marden Lecture. I've got to say, on a personal note, for those of us who were drudging away on these issues for years and years, his talk, which was titled "The Legal Profession and the Unmet Needs of the Immigrant Poor," came at us like a gift from the legal gods from above, and we were extraordinarily grateful for it. Following his lecture, Judge Katzmann convened a study group on how to increase legal representation, pro bono representation to low-income immigrants. And that study group has been regularly meeting. And his work has been highly successful in terms of generating more pro bono support for this work. And I know it's inspired the ABA's commission work as well on this report. Judge Katzmann is going to be speaking on the quality of decision-making before the immigration courts and the Board of Immigration Appeals. He's also going to speak on access to counsel issues and the burdens placed on courts of appeals by excessive immigration filings and immigration appeals. He's going to be followed by Karen Grisey, who chairs the ABA Commission on Immigration. Karen is a good friend and one of the most distinguished litigators in the immigration field. She serves on the boards of the Washington Council of Lawyers, the Capital Area Immigrant Rights Coalition, and the American Immigration Council. She's also played a leadership role in the BIA Pro Bono Project, which is a national program that matches unrepresented asylum seekers and others before the Board of Immigration Appeals with pro bono counsel. And in her spare time, she serves as the Public Services Counsel for the law firm of Fried Frank, Harris, Shriver, and Jacobson, coordinating all of that firm's extensive pro bono work and projects. Karen's going to speak from the perspective of a practitioner on the exercise of discretion in cases before the immigration courts and before the board. And I should say that Karen and Andy Schoenholtz, who can't be with us today, were the two commissioners, the ABA commissioners, who were most active and took a leadership role in producing this report. And I also want to recognize Megan Mack, who's maybe Megan, you can raise your hand here, who directs and staffs the ABA Commission on Immigration and played a vital role in bringing this report and project to fruition, as she does with all of the ABA's good work on these issues. So thank you for that, Megan. And our final speaker to my right will be Lauren Schneider, who's a senior partner in the law firm of Arnold and Porter, where he heads the firm's international trade practice. Larry is an immensely accomplished trade attorney and has been involved in good work on the immigration side for years and years. For present purposes, he's the person who led a team of more than 50 pro bono attorneys, Arnold and Porter attorneys, for more than a year on this project. These attorneys did exhaustive research on the law, on the constituent parts of this system. They interviewed countless officials and other stakeholders in the system. And I've got to say, you know, while many of the report's recommendations are going to be debated, it's really a credit to Larry and his team that the overall result has been the most comprehensive and thoughtful analysis of the removal adjudication system in many, many years, and in my memory anyway. I've never read anything like it. Larry's going to speak on the report's recommendations related to an Article I or an independent agency immigration court, as well as on federal judicial review. So as a segue into our speakers, let me provide some quick observations on the report, some background facts, and then speak very briefly about the beginning of the removal adjudication process. You know, the study makes a number of high-profile recommendations, dozens of them, in fact. However, it seems to me that the greatest contribution that it makes is its analysis of the system is a living and breathing whole. In other words, it explores how the stages of this system work both individually and together, how they relate together, how problems at one stage affect the entire system, and how the system can be improved both in terms of its efficiency, but just as importantly, in terms of ensuring that the best decisions are made under U.S. law. It proposes legislative reforms, but it also focuses on the need for effectively exercising discretion, for better decision-making, more quality decision-making at each stage of the process, and where needed, for more resources. And I think the challenges really start at the beginning of the process with the placement by DHS of persons into removal proceedings. You know, in the criminal context or in any analogous adversarial court proceeding, the police or the investigators wouldn't decide who gets prosecuted and who goes into court. It's the prosecuting attorney who decides whether to proceed with the case based on prosecutorial priorities, the availability of resources, and frankly, the likelihood of prevailing in the case. Yet, in the immigration removal system, USCIS, CBP, Border Patrol supervisors, ICE officials can all initiate removal proceedings, which the trial counsel and the courts then have to live with and deal with. And in 2009, DHS referred nearly 330,000 cases to the immigration courts. Yet the Executive Office for Immigration Review, the immigration judges, had only 232 judges to handle these cases. So doing the math, which is always dangerous when attorneys start to do this, and I checked it against the ABA math, which might be even more dangerous, each judge would have to accommodate more than 1,400 cases per year just to meet the filing demand. In fact, immigration judges completed 290,000 cases in 2009, which is remarkable, but it's also troubling given the complexity of these cases and the immense stakes involved for the individuals in court. Notwithstanding these numbers, you might be comforted or you know, depending on your perspective, horrified if these immigrants had legal counsel to help them to develop and to present their cases. But only 39% of the people in immigration court did have legal counsel, which actually is a horrifying fact. In addition, for the first time in memory, most people in immigration court are now detained, making it more difficult for them to find counsel and to represent themselves. Not surprisingly, the system is buckling under the workload. Just yesterday, the Transactional Records Access Clearinghouse, also known as TRAC, reported that the number of pending cases in immigration court has just reached an all-time high of 242,776, so 242,000 pending cases. In addition, whether or not one can prevail in court often turns less on the merits of a particular case, as Andy Schoenholtz and his researchers have shown, than on whether an immigrant can afford legal counsel. We know that the immigration laws have become more stringent in recent years. The ABA report proposes legislative fixes to restore discretion to immigration judges to consider the equities in particular cases. It also recommends that DHS pilot a program in which DHS counsel would review all cases before they're referred for removal proceedings. Again, the idea is to let those who have to live with these cases decide which cases to pursue. This decision should be based on enforcement priorities. people who are eligible or almost eligible to adjust status, for example, are not likely to be removed and thus shouldn't be placed in removal proceedings. And, of course, there would be other priorities as well. But putting people who don't belong there into removal proceedings only frustrates judges and wastes scarce resources. EOIR is now in the process of hiring 47 new judges, including 28 approved under its 2010 budget. Another 21 have been requested for 2011. That would bring the total to 300. These increases, of course, are going to help, but with the Secure Communities Program and other major enforcement programs gearing up, the numbers placed in removal will likely only increase, and thus the Department of Justice and the immigration judges may be in precisely the same predicament or a worse predicament a few years from now, despite the increases in immigration judges. Rounding out the picture before I turn to Judge Katzmann, most of you know that the BIA streamlining rules in 2002 led to increased single-member review of cases, more affirmances without opinions, and fewer judges. And these developments, in turn, led to immense increases in appeals to the federal courts of appeal, particularly in the Second Circuit and the Ninth Circuits. This is precisely the kind of situation that an administrative court is supposed to prevent. The number of appeals to U.S. courts of appeals spiked at nearly 13,000 in 2005. That's remarkable. These numbers have fallen steadily since then to about 7,200 in 2009. And, in fact, the percentage of BIA cases that are appealed has also been falling. However, the BIA workload is still immense. The board received about 33,000 cases in 2009, but it has only 15 permanent BIA members, some temporary judges, and then a group of about 120 attorneys to tackle these cases. And the immigration-related workload of the federal court judges remains daunting. It's so substantial, in fact, that Chief Justice Roberts, in his annual report on the federal judiciary, highlighted immigration cases, attributing the overall 6% drop in filings in courts of appeals mainly to the drop in appeals from the BIA, but noting the record increases in immigration-related prosecutions in federal district courts, most of these attributable to prosecutions for illegal entry. So, immigration policy has clearly arrived as a prime concern. It has been for a number of years for the federal judiciary. Let me, I think that's probably enough background and a good segue into Judge Katzmann's comments and to the substance of the ABA's work. And before I turn to Judge Katzmann, again, I just wanted to thank you for being with us today, and it's great to have you here.
Hi. Thank you. It's a great... Can you hear me? Yeah, it's a great privilege to be here. I really admire the work of so many people in this room, and the panel. Don Kerwin has just been an extraordinary force in this area for a long time. And when I began work in this area, reading Don Kerwin's work was extraordinarily informative and useful, and it was great to get him involved in our processes. While I'm not in a position as a judge to comment on the particular recommendations of the ABA report, I want to say that as a judge, what the ABA has done in its work represents the very best of pro bono lawyering, of lawyers taking seriously their responsibility to the larger community to foster the access for justice, especially for those who are in need. And I applaud very much the efforts of Karen, of Megan, and of Larry and his team, which spent so much time in delving into every aspect of the immigration adjudication system. And I commend to you reading the report There's the executive summary, and then there's a detailed report. Just to get a sense of how the system works, whether or not you agree with the particular recommendations, I think the report becomes a starting point for understanding the system as it is. So I say hats off to you for doing all that. A few words about how I got into this, and then I'll move into some issues. As Don pointed out, really in 2002, the federal courts were faced, especially in the Second and Ninth Circuits, with a seeming avalanche of immigration cases that had come from the BIA. The Second Circuit and the Courts of Appeals generally became the, in essence, the first avenue of thorough review in so many of these cases, because the Board of Immigration Appeals at that time, and things have improved, I should say, quite a lot, but at that time in 2002, we were reviewing summary affirmances, opinions by one judge rather than a panel of judges. We were reviewing cases where there were very few precedential opinions being issued by the BIA, and so because the cases came directly from the BIA to the Court of Appeals, there was no intervening district court. We became the first line of review, effectively, for much of these cases. And over time, just to give you a sense, every week we would get, in the beginning, between 32 and 48 cases a week of immigration cases. Now it's each three-judge panel gets about 12 to 16 cases a week, apart from all of our other work. In the period between 2006 and 2009, 13 active judges, with a few senior judges participating, adjudicated 13,000 immigration cases in the Second Circuit alone. So that gives you a sense of the volume of cases that the Second Circuit has been handling. In the context of all these cases, and seeing them every week, the first thing that one was struck by, at least I was struck by, was the very poor quality of lawyering in these cases. And Don gave you some of the data. What was so troubling was that these are cases not where there was an absence of counsel, and we know, as from the statistic that Don said, that there's a larger systemic problem, that is, only 39% of non-citizens have counsel in the if you look at the immigration proceedings as a whole. Of the cases that we see in the Second Circuit, most of the cases are counseled, but the quality of counseling is very uneven. There are some, certainly dedicated immigration lawyers who serve their clients well, but all too often, the quality of counsel is defective. And by that I mean the filing of boilerplate briefs, where the immigrant's name is just substituted from one brief to another without careful thought. And so the problem of representation, quality representation, becomes a very huge issue. As one clearly has the sense from the perspective of a judge that if only the quality of representation had been higher, the outcome might have been different. And the frustration from a court of appeals judge's perspective is that by the time a case gets to us, we are often constrained by various administrative law doctrines as to our substituting our views for what went on below. So what it means is that having quality counsel at the very outset of the process makes all the difference between success and failure. And and as Don pointed out, I've worked to create a series of working groups, and we've been doing work in this area. And if any of you have any interest in that, because it very much dovetails with the work of the commission, it's available online. Our latest reports are available through the Fordham Law Review. Anyway, what I think the report does in part, just beginning with representation as an issue, is it highlights how fundamental representation is. There are different ways of trying to promote representation, but what is so critical and what is so important to understand is that it all begins with representation. Because if you don't have a good lawyer, you're really behind the eight ball. There are a variety of proposals out there in terms of increasing pro bono activity. There are other proposals that are more legislative in nature. The bottom line is representation is critical, and the report certainly highlights that as an issue. Going to the area of immigration courts and the functioning of the courts, I'm very much struck by the incredible burdens that immigration courts are under. Russell Wheeler of the Governance Institute and a fellow at the Brookings Institution has been looking into issues comparing courts and Article III courts, federal courts, and courts like the Immigration Court. His background is as being the leading student, really, and administrator of the courts for many years at the Federal Judicial Center. And it's striking because one of the data points that he picked up on, which is very much something that is that the report, I think, is also looking at, is if you compare the workload of a trial court judge with that of an immigration judge, the burdens, the disparity in burdens is remarkable. In the year 2008, the average disposition of federal district courts was something like 480 cases. I'm not talking about motions, but I'm talking about cases to disposition. And whereas the report and Don has pointed out, the immigration court disposition is something like 1,200 cases. So what does that mean? That means that an immigration court has to deal with approximately four cases a day. Now, these are very labor-intensive cases. They involve incredible amount of data that have to be processed. They're very time-consuming, and it boggles the mind that any judge, and I'm assuming diligence on the part of the judges, and the judges in our circuit are really quite diligent. It boggles the mind that anybody could really deal with four cases a day. And when you consider the immigrants have language difficulties, they have poor representation. It defies imagination that these cases can be resolved with the kind of deliberation that is required. So that's really a systemic issue. It doesn't go to any particular immigration judge, but just an institutional problem. Another problem that the report highlights or makes note of is the resources that are available to immigration courts. And here again, a comparison to a federal district court is instructive. The average active judge on in a district court has three clerks. Some of them will take two, but most of them have three clerks per judge. And those are law clerks who are extremely helpful in terms of providing research, providing drafting capacity with respect to memos and opinions. The immigration court judges now share the one clerk per about four four immigration judges. It used to be, just a couple of years ago, something like six or seven. So here you have these judges who have all these burdens to begin with without resources in terms of clerk support. Another challenge is the very uneven, to put it mildly, translation services. At the immigration court, where the record is so fundamental in terms of an immigrant's chances, to the extent that translation services are inadequate, that is a huge problem. Because the findings of the immigration court, to the extent that they're based on translation issues and become credibility findings, become very difficult to change as the appeals process goes forward. So that's a great difficulty as well. Another concern is the concern about disparity across the country, and there are statistical data which is available when you read the report and other stuff that's out there, and the disparity across the country in terms of the granting of asylum rates leads one to wonder what sort of uniformity of law is there. So those are just some concerns with respect to the immigration courts that I would highlight. And then looking at the Board of Immigration Appeals, there was a great luck. People do matter in government, and when Juan Osuna became chair of the BIA, he really did a lot to try to change the BIA, and the BIA issues far fewer opinions by summary affirmances than they used to, and they're issuing far more opinions that are of a precedential nature, and that's all been to the good. But at the same time, as Don pointed out, I want to reinforce, the workload of the BIA is still very substantial, and the number of judges are fewer than there once were, I think that's a real problem as well. My time's just about up, but I just wanted to say that in each of these areas, representation, adjudication through the immigration courts and the BIA, that the report really does a superb job of highlighting the issues. There are obviously some things that could be done very quickly, like expanding the legal orientation programs, having them include both detainees and non-detainees. The legal orientation programs, which I think I'm sure most of you are familiar with, are an effort to provide counseling to non-citizens through various service providers. And we're very glad that New York City will be getting one, such a program. But those could be expanded beyond that. I think there are efforts that can be undertaken, for example, in terms of rooting out fraud. And here the ABA, if you go to the ABA's commission's website, you'll learn about project having to do with notarial fraud. Indeed, for those of you who are just generalists, a great place to go is the ABA commission's website, because they really provide all sorts of important information and links and data that I think are so beneficial. So with that, I think I'll stop. But again, I feel very privileged to be here. The great work of Don Kerwin and his colleagues, and the fantastic dedication of Larry Schneider and Karen and Megan. So.
Thank you, everybody. Thanks for being here with us this morning. I have to start just for a minute with my own round of thank yous. First to Don. He gave credit to Andy Schoenholtz and to me for the work on the report, but he neglected his own contribution. You know, Don's a member of the commission as well and was also involved in substantial amount of the work on this, and I'm very grateful to Don not only for that, but to giving us a forum here at MPI to continue a discussion about some of the issues that are presented in the ABA report and arise from it, and in particular some of those issues that have gotten less of the attention in the media and public debate level. So I'm really looking forward to the discussion part of the program with folks here. With regard to my friend Larry here from Arnold and Porter, I have said in every possible venue, and I can't fail to say it again, the tremendous level of gratitude that the ABA Commission has to Arnold and Porter for this piece of work. 13 or 14,000 pro bono hours over the course of about 18 months. So you see the quality of the work in front of you, but the level of commitment and the professionalism cannot be overstated. And I want to make sure everybody gives due regard to Larry and the entire team that has supported him in this effort for bringing us the product that enables us to have these discussions. And about Judge Katzmann, I must say he's the best possible ally that we could have found to help us address these issues. Everybody knows that when a judge is present, the presence of a judge will get people to come to a program or come to an event or listen or respond to a letter or return a phone call. But in Judge Katzmann, we have the best of both worlds, because he's not only willing to use his leadership role to galvanize attention to the issue, but he has the substantive knowledge, as you've heard, coming out of the cases that he has personally seen and the burdens that have been placed on his court, and seeing these cases and the quality of the decisions that are in part a function of the lack of resources in the system that he has seen have given him the ability to speak in a meaningful way about the issues and really to provide examples to folks who will listen about the need for some of the reforms that it happens that we're also talking about in the ABA report. So I want to thank Judge Katzmann, too, for the personal level of energy and commitment that he's brought to his work on this and when called for to the Traveling Roadshow to help continue the discussion.
Karen asks, you don't say no.
or she'll ask again. But anyway, I wanted to talk this morning a little bit, as Don said, from a practitioner's perspective, because I think since the report has been out and even before that, a lot of the discussion always focuses on policy issues. What the immigration policy should be, what the resource level should be, what outcomes should be in a sort of up in the stratosphere kind of level, a macro level, if you will. And I wanted to sort of bring it back to the level of real people, real cases, and why it matters to put some flesh on the bones of these policy issues as we're talking about them. So sort of walking through, not exactly, but in general terms, through the chapters of the report, which I think folks may know are, number one, the issue of notices to appear and who should be in removal proceedings generally, then moving through immigration courts, the Board of Immigration Appeals, and the circuit courts, the issue of representation, and then ending up with the structure of the system as a whole and the issue of the structure of what the immigration court system should be and our recommendation for an Article I court that Larry will talk more about. Just touching on some of those practical issues, who should be in proceedings to start with? A couple of the our concerns are about who should be in proceedings from the very beginning, who actually should receive a notice to appear from the Department of Homeland Security, and then who should remain in proceedings as the case progresses, and where are the junctures at which somebody should properly come out of that removal adjudication system and into either another disposition or another forum. One case that I know of that illustrates the point about who should be in proceedings from the very beginning is a case that arose because an elderly man was in a nursing home on life support, and his daughters filed an application for permanent residence on his behalf because he needed they believed that he was eligible for permanent residence, and he needed the benefits to assist with the cost of his nursing home care. That application for permanent residence actually was denied because and I have no argument with that at all. It came out that he had a pre-IRIRA, pre-96 immigration reform drug-related conviction. It was 30 years in the past, which highlights the retroactivity concerns. But regardless, under the statute, he was not eligible for adjustment of status. He couldn't become a permanent resident. But what happened is when that came to light as a result of the processing of the green card application, he was then issued a notice to appear and was put into removal proceedings. So at the first master calendar hearing, the daughters appeared to explain why he was not able to be present because he's in a nursing home on life support. The judge asked the trial attorney, did you know that or what did you think about that? And the trial attorney's response was, yes, they had let us know and we called and we verified indeed that he is in such and such a nursing home. So the upshot of it is that the judge terminated removal proceedings because the judge said, I can't proceed against somebody who's not, it's undisputed, is not conscious and can't be physically present. And even made some comment to the trial attorneys about, you're not telling me you're really going to, disconnect this person and remove them anyway, so why are we here? But the government said, no, you're right, Your Honor, we are not going to remove the person, but he has an aggravated felony conviction, and we have a right to a final order. And the judge terminated, and the government appealed the case to the Board of Immigration Appeals. So the The point that I'm trying to illustrate is the point of discretion and making judgments about which cases should actually be consuming resources in the system. There's another case that I'm aware of, which is not at the beginning, but during the pendency of proceedings. Again, someone perfectly appropriately in removal proceedings, but during the course of the proceedings, the spouse became very seriously ill, extremely seriously ill. So there were issues of hardship to the U.S. citizen spouse and the need for the respondent to be able to remain in the United States to care for the spouse. There was tremendous amount of documentation in the case, and the response of the trial attorney and the supervisors was, when we raised issues about prosecutorial discretion and so forth, was, look, you can stipulate to an order, you can litigate to an order. You're right, there's a good case for prosecutorial discretion, and we'll talk to you about deferred action or a stay after you have an order, but no conversation until there's a final order in the case. So that caused several years of litigation through a circuit court removal order, because under the law, the man was clearly removable and not entitled to relief. And then we ended up with stays as a matter of discretion for 5 or 6 years after that because of the wife's illness. And again, I think it's a case that illustrates where the issue is not as much the law, but the practicality of forcing these cases through proceedings when there's not an active intent to remove the person. We have a recommendation in the report also that people who are facially eligible to adjust their status, people who are married to the U.S. citizens and don't have any bars to admissibility, when these cases arise, should not be placed in removal proceedings and should instead be able to pursue their adjustment of status administratively before CIS. Similarly, we have a recommendation that asylum seekers who come into the system through the expedited removal process and pass credible fear interviews now, under the current system, must pursue their asylum claims through the adversarial process before the immigration courts and beyond if necessary. And we have a recommendation that folks who, through the credible fear process similarly, are found not to have any bars to asylum, no criminal history or national security concerns, that those people also should be deviated to the affirmative asylum process so that the specially trained asylum adjudicators could adjudicate those claims without consuming the resources of the immigration court system. And similar to the affirmative process now, if for some reason they can't be granted, if they're not readily approvable, that those cases would then come back into the adversarial process. But in the first instance, they would have a chance to be processed without the great resources that those claims need. A few other examples I'll give you. Is the issue of maintaining appeals. I think all too frequently the ICE either pursues appeals or pursues repeated appeals to the Board of Immigration Appeals, and I'm going to say particularly with regard to the exercise of discretion. I know of one case that I have personally where the case consumed 12 years before resulting in a grant of asylum, 3 times grants of asylum by 2 different immigration judges, but with 2 intervening appeals by the government to the Board of Immigration Appeals. And the second one, which consumed about the last 3 or 4 years of that process, purely on the exercise of discretion. And I have to say, as Judge Katzman noted, at the end of the day, the Board of Immigration Appeals did the right thing, and the correct outcome happened, but it's the time and the resources and the impact of the time on the respondents. And I'm going to jump ahead a little bit. The cases that I'm talking about and the cases that I know about are normally ones where lawyers were involved. The cases that are of greatest concern to me and the ones we can't talk about are the ones where people never found counsel, and the types of problems that we're discussing happened, and there was no one in there to see them or raise them, and thus not correct them. So the opportunities for poor decisions in initiating proceedings and pursuing certain litigating positions. If there's no counsel, these things don't have a chance to be corrected, and then obviously have huge difficulties for the individuals involved. Cancellation of removal is a place where I would highlight that I think the government very frequently litigates, particularly on the exercise of discretion, to the BIA, and they certainly have the legal right to do that. The board has jurisdiction to review those claims, but I would say that generally speaking, reversals on grants of cancellation of removal are low. There tends to be a great deal of deference to the judges who have seen the person and balance the equities, and that's, again, another category of cases clogging things up at the board, rarely going anywhere. And I will say, I don't know if this is still the policy, but there in the past, I've been informed there was a policy that ICE was required to litigate all grants of relief under the Convention Against Torture to the Board of Immigration Appeals. And as I said, I don't know if that's still the policy, but I think that is certainly a good place for increased exercise of discretion. A simple review of the facts of a case on the merits should reveal whether that's a case that should go up on appeal or not. But blanket policies like that certainly would seem to consume undue resources. Backlogs and delays, this isn't squarely a point about the exercise of discretion, but it relates to the issue of which cases should be in the system and when discretion should be exercised. I had a case at the Board of Immigration Appeals recently that was a NACARA case, a special rule cancellation of removal for a Central American. In a non-detained case, very simple, one straightforward issue, non-detained case was at the board 11 months, fully briefed before the decision came out. So we won the case at the BIA. The individual was found eligible for permanent residence based on NACARA. So the BIA decision came in May. We now have the first master calendar coming back in the immigration court in November. That'll be for updating of fingerprints and then another hearing for the guy to actually get the green card. So it's probably going to be 18 months or 2 years and the need to renew the work permit two times before he gets the benefit, even for somebody that's been found to be eligible. So these are people's lives, and these are real hardships. And again, these are cases that if we had a better mechanism for adjudicating them, they wouldn't be in the system to begin with. One point on ex parte communications that goes a little to Larry's Article 1 point. Under the current system, and this is something that the National Association of Immigration Judges has talked about a lot, the immigration judges are not regarded as judges within the DOJ system. They're regarded as attorney adjudicators. So the same concerns that in the regular civil or criminal system would pertain about ex parte communications don't exist. I learned it the hard way in a case I had out of the former Soviet Union, an asylum case, and there was an issue of whether the person had become stateless or not. So the immigration judge had set up a briefing schedule for me to file my brief on statelessness, and then the government, if it chose, would oppose. And the time elapsed, and I didn't get anything. So I called the trial attorney to say, did you file a brief? Did I not get it? Or are you not filing one? And the trial attorney said, oh, yeah, I told the judge last week I was before her on another matter, and I told her we're not going to file. And I'm like, okay, well, thanks, but, you know, I wish she would have told me, because here I am, like, writing my opposition. And in this case, it didn't hurt me. It didn't hurt my client. But it illustrates the point that these kind of communications where the briefing schedule is made on the record and the issues are discussed with the judge, follow-up communication shouldn't be in the absence of one of the parties. And people taking positions about what they are or aren't going to litigate should be done in front of everyone, and again raises the issue of pro se cases. So my time is basically up. The only other thing that I want to say that Don had asked me to take a minute on is to discuss the question of detention and its impact on access to counsel and on substantive outcomes. I'm sure everybody here knows that most detention centers are in remote locations that are far away from the metropolitan areas where most lawyers are located. It's exceedingly difficult to identify pro bono counsel to take cases when they have to drive three or four hours in each direction for every single meeting with their client. And for issues of preparation for hearing and asylum claims in particular, where it takes a lot of meetings and a lot of effort to develop a rapport to get the full story and get all the facts to the extent the client is able even to remember or articulate the facts, this remote location and inability of confidential communications is a huge, huge problem. We heard already from Andy's work through Refugee Roulette that having a lawyer is the single biggest determinant on the outcome of asylum cases. It's certainly true with regard to forms of other relief as well. So anything, detention being one of those things that impairs people's ability to obtain counsel, also impairs the outcome. The related issue is transfers. When people are shifted around the country from one place to another, they're moved away from their family members. Let's leave to the side totally the issue of getting a lawyer. They lose the ability of witnesses to come to court or to be heard if the judges don't allow telephonic testimony. Often they lose documents. And the issue of the fact of detention and transfers also impairs their ability to receive mail if there are important documents coming from overseas or even from home within the United States. It also impairs their ability to get mail out. And I'm sure Judge Katzman has probably seen cases where part of the issues that arise are pro se people who didn't file something on time or didn't have evidence in time or weren't able to obtain a required translation and therefore couldn't meet their burden of corroboration under the Real ID Act because of things that arise not from the merits of the case but from the burdens imposed by detention itself. So that's all I'll say about the problems of real people and the impact of these issues that the report addresses on real cases.
Thank you, Don. Karen, Judge Katzman, it's a privilege to be on this panel with you today. I would like to talk about PR. And I don't just mean public relations, but also problems and recommendations. As evidenced by the numerous articles and judicial decisions that have criticized the removal adjudication system, there certainly are PR, in the sense of public relations, problems for the current system. But behind those PR problems, there also are many real problems that require real recommendations for real change, not simply good PR. In our report, which this is the executive summary, and there's a separate volume that is four times as long with the detailed report. We have gone through a detailed analysis where we seek to identify the numerous problems that are plaguing the removal adjudication system. And after considering many options, we offer numerous recommendations for action. For action within the existing system, to address many of those problems through policy changes, regulatory changes, legislative changes. And there's a nice table at the end of the executive summary, table ES1, that lists about 60 recommendations that we make overall. And many of those are these policy changes, regulatory and legislative changes to the system as it currently exists. Those recommendations include changes with respect to DHS that Karen was describing, to the immigration courts, to the Board of Immigration Appeals, to representation by counsel, and to review by the Federal Circuit courts. For example, just briefly, with respect to judicial review, we recommend restoring judicial review of discretionary decisions under the abuse of discretion standard that existed prior to 1996. We recommend permitting the courts of appeals to remand cases for further fact-finding. We recommend extending the current 30-day deadline for filing petitions for review to provide 60 days for filing a petition with the possibility of a 30-day extension for good cause or excusable neglect. And we recommend requiring removal orders that are issued by the BIA after the government prevails before the BIA to contain notice of appeal rights, to indicate the court to which an appeal has to be filed, and the deadline for filing an appeal. All those recommendations are laid out in detail in the full volume and in summary in the executive report, executive summary, and in the table at the back that I mentioned. Now, substantial improvements can be made through such changes within the existing structure. However, not all of the problems can be adequately addressed within the existing system. These problems include the lack of independence of immigration judges, the lack of independence of the Board of Immigration Appeals as parts of the Department of Justice. These problems include the lack of fairness and the perception of fairness towards non-citizens. These problems include a structure that limits the ability of the Department of Justice to attract the highest quality judges who can do their jobs and make decisions without fear of arbitrary termination, of transfer, or other sanctions, being part of the political system. And so we ask the question, should the current overall structure of the removal adjudication be changed? And if so, how should it be changed? And as you will see detailed in the report, we considered three basic restructuring options. First, the creation of an Article I court, an independent court system that would replace all of the existing immigration courts and the BIA. Would include both a trial level and an appellate level. Secondly, we considered an independent agency, a new executive adjudicatory agency, independent of all other executive agencies, that would replace, again, both the trial level and the appellate level. And thirdly, we considered a hybrid, which would involve taking the trial level adjudicators and putting them in an independent administrative agency, and putting the appellate level tribunal in an Article I court. So those are the three basic options that we decided to look at. And in looking at those options, we explored the differences between Article I courts and independent agencies. We reviewed current examples of each type of system. We reviewed prior proposals that have been made by various organizations and groups. And then we tried to define the specific features of each of these three options so that we had something specific, very concrete, to focus on. Now, one of the things that we found is that it's theoretically possible to define the features of an Article I court system and an independent agency model that look almost the same, because there's no clear legal distinction between the two. If you look at the various models that exist, the various examples that exist, you'll see that a lot just depends upon what Congress has decided to do with these agencies or with these courts. But in making our proposals, we believed that we should create models that draw upon those existing models for other adjudicatory systems in our federal system. And so we've defined the features of an Article I court that resemble existing Article I courts. And similarly, for an independent agency, we've looked at independent agencies for the basic features. And we've defined those key features of each of those three models, again, in another table at the back of the executive summary, table ES2, and it lays out the key features of each of those three options. And what you'll see, in very short terms, is that the Article 1 court model and the independent agency model differ primarily with respect to selection of judges, the tenure and term of office of judges, and the discipline and removal system. And a lot of the other things can be pretty similar. For an independent agency, we define the terms using a civil service type of system that's similar to but not the same as the current system for ALJs. And for an Article I court, we've used, of course, a judicial model with fixed terms of office and other aspects of a judicial system. And then we took these three models with these particular features, and we compared them based upon six criteria. Now, four of the criteria are in the title of the report: independence, fairness, efficiency, and professionalism. And those are the standards that we tried to use throughout our report as we examined each of our recommendations. But we added two others in looking at this restructuring of the court system. We looked also at accountability to the political branches, which is often an issue, and the impact on Article III courts, on the federal courts of appeals, of these approaches. And there's another table at the back of the executive summary, table ES3, that briefly summarizes the differences based upon those criteria among those three options. Now, you can read the whole report and get all the details, and in fact, there's a whole appendix of dozens of pages, appendix 6A, that goes into great detail looking at existing Article I courts, looking at existing adjudicatory agencies, and analyzing each of those in detail. But let me just summarize in terms of our selection among these options to say that, starting with the hybrid approach, that has a lot of intellectual appeal. It would have, as I said, the trial court in an independent agency, and then an appeal to an Article I court. But, as I just described it, that would involve creating two new entities, two separate institutions, and therefore it would be the most complex and costly of the options in terms of implementation. And we didn't find any advantages of the hybrid option that were significant enough to outweigh those cost and complexity disadvantages. And so we didn't recommend the hybrid option. Instead, we focused on the choice between an Article I court and an independent agency. Now, for an independent agency, there are definitely some attractions, which include the independence and professionalism that would result from the treatment of trial judges in a manner similar to administrative law judges with respect to selection and tenure and evaluation and discipline. And the agency, by using a civil service type of process, should have pretty good ability to fill and maintain a large number of judgeships. We're talking about a lot of positions, 230 right now, and we've recommended an increase of another 100 judges because the system is so under-resourced right now. That's a lot of judges. That's a big judicial system. And the civil service type of process can be pretty effective in filling that. And another potential advantage of the independent agency model is it would be viewed as less of a radical departure from the current system, and there are many precedents in independent agencies that exist today. Now, the Article I court model is likely, in our view, to be viewed as more independent than an agency because it would be a wholly judicial body. We think that as a wholly judicial body, it's likely to engender the greatest level of confidence in its results. We think that it can use its greater prestige to attract the best candidates for judgeships. And we think it offers the best balance between independence and accountability to the political branches of the federal government, since the judges would have fixed terms and would be subject to presidential appointment, at least at the senior levels, and confirmation by the Senate. When you weigh these different advantages and disadvantages of different models, we came out that the advantages I pointed to and some others that are discussed in the report, that the Article I court model is the preferred option. We think that's the better way to go. But the independent agency model also would be an enormous improvement over the current system, and it offers a strong alternative to an Article I court. And obviously this is something that's going to end up being a decision not made in this room, but made between the White House and Capitol Hill. And so we think either of those options have tremendous advantages. We think that the better of the two is the Article I court. So let's go back for a moment to PR. if the problems in the current system are addressed through our recommendations, including our system restructuring recommendations, then we think that there will be real improvement in the removal adjudication system. And hopefully that real improvement in the system will be accompanied by improved public relations in the classic PR sense. And we think that those improvements in the system and the better PR would be good both for the system and for our country. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, good. We have thanks for those presentations. They were terrific. We have about half an hour now for questions. I certainly have some questions, but I let's hear from you as well. And yeah, in the back. And if you could identify yourself, please.
Hi, I'm Pamela Goldberg with UNHCR. I want to first say this has been a tremendously wonderful panel. So clear, everyone in sync. It's just, I hope that these remarks will be published because they're just superb. And I want to thank you for that and also for the wonderful report.
It will be online.
Great.
We'll run it online, yep.
Wonderful. And I also want to thank you for the report and the tremendous work that you all put into it and its value. I haven't read the whole report yet, but I look forward to. I have so many questions, but I thought I would limit it to take advantage of Judge Katzmann's presence here and focus on something that you mentioned and something that has been an issue that we've thought about among ourselves at UNHCR and with some of our colleagues, and that is the question about consistency and how that interfaces with judicial autonomy and independence. And you talked about how is there any, I forgot how you put it, any established law that it raises the question when you see such disparity, that it raises the question of is there any independent, is there any solid law that people, judges, are drawing from? And so the question is whether you see it as a matter of, when you talk about that issue, as a matter of interpretation of the law, application, is it more in the discretionary findings like credibility? How do you see that issue, and how do you balance that against the need for autonomy of judges in their decision making?
That's a huge question, from my perspective, the cases that I see are cases arising in the Second Circuit, and there, I think that. For the most part, one does see kind of a consistency among the cases that we get from the immigration courts, and there is law that's established. The concern that I was raising was just the disparity rates across the country, and the question of why there is that disparity, and sometimes disparity results from just differences in factual circumstance, and so what appears to be a disparity can actually be explained in a very rational way. But when there are large disparity rates and differences, then that certainly raises the question, and it goes to questions. And I know the report is interested in looks at some of this. It goes to questions having to do with is it a disparity a function of recruitment? Is it a function of training? Those are just some of the questions that come to light. I was simply raising an issue or highlighting an issue that everyone in this room knows about, and simply saying that it deserves more attention. I'm sorry that I don't have a more coherent answer. Thank you.
Yep. Sure.
Good morning. My name is David North. I'm with the Center for Immigration Studies, another think tank in Washington, D.C. My sense is that the people who appear before the immigration judiciary systems that we've been talking about are seeking a rather large boon from the United States government, which is not to be deported, to put it bluntly. And I'm wondering, and this is just a factual question, whether or not there's any requirement of those coming before these various bodies to have paid their federal income tax.
Many of the applications for relief, many but not all, and I'll exclude in particular asylum seekers who have come to the United States, asylum seekers and those seeking related forms of protection, those individuals don't have an obligation to pay federal income taxes before the grant of a benefit because they haven't been in the United States or had earnings that would impose such an obligation on them. That's for newly arrived asylum seekers. For people who have been in the United States a long time and may be seeking asylum, they have other issues associated with delay, but then payment or non-payment of income taxes could be an issue going to the exercise of discretion. Similarly, on cancellation of removal, on adjustment of status, and all of those forms of relief that are non-protection related, non-asylum related, the payment or non-payment of income taxes is a positive or negative factor that goes to the exercise of discretion at a minimum. And in the adjustment of status context, it comes up because if there's a sponsoring relative, the income level of the sponsoring relative has to be documented, which also requires the submission of tax returns to show the ability to pay. But for most people and most applications for relief, it is a factor that comes into play on the exercise of discretion.
Thank you.
Hi, good morning. Thank you so much. My name is Amber Jade. I'm the Community Outreach Director for the Asian Pacific Islander Domestic Violence Resource Project, or DVRP. We're local. We serve clients D.C., Maryland, Virginia. So if anybody wants to get involved with that, we don't do legal services in-house. And as you can imagine, that's one of the most hardest things that our clients face and our advocates face in trying to find legal services for our clients. My question might broaden things a bit, and so I appreciate any thoughts you can share, but DVRP definitely is involved and interested in immigration reform. Particularly, we've been working with a coalition of folks here in D.C. who I can say to date, I think our advocacy has successfully prevented the implementation of secure communities here in D.C. And as we've been talking with, the council and MPD about issues with ICE being involved and things, we really are talking about how programs like that are creating, dragnets in the community and fear in the community for immigrants, especially to come forward and report crimes like domestic violence or trafficking. And so I'm just curious if there was any recommendations or things, thoughts you guys had towards ICE and DHS on things, a lot of things like they're trying to do to enhance their efficiency, like having handheld, fingerprint devices in the future where they can actually screen out in the community before detaining someone, either wrongfully or rightfully. We have issues with, again, civil rights and, the environment and scare tactics in the community. Any thoughts you guys can share on that? Thanks.
I mean, I don't think so. I think to the extent that the report was looking at these issues, it was looking at who was coming into the system to start with. It looked at the removal adjudication system from, DHS referrals to, through the kind of federal court of appeals. And it just made note of the fact that it looked like an awful lot of cases were coming into the and being placed in removal that shouldn't be placed in removal, and that there ought to be some formal way to kind of make decisions based on prosecutorial discretion and enforcement priorities as to who should come into the system, and that those decisions should also be made by the people that have to live with them, And it's a very kind of hodgepodge decision at this point. CIS can do it, Border Patrol, executive people can do it, first-line supervisors, CBP, ICE, and the like. And so that there needs to be some control on that, because that begins the process of clogging the system, making for inefficiencies and poor decisions down the line. Yep.
My name is Anna Sol Gutierrez. I'm a state delegate in Maryland, and I want to thank you for incredibly thorough treatment of this issue that is so important. My question as a practical legislator is, what are kind of the next steps? Two questions. Has this kind of recommendation of creating a new A1 level court, I'm not a lawyer, is there a precedence for that? Have we done that in the United States before? And second, are your recommendations, do you know if they're being looked at any of the two proposals that are currently looking at comprehensive immigration reform, both by Congressman Gutierrez as well as with the Schumer proposal? Thank you.
And actually, I'd like to broaden that. That's a great question. I'd like to broaden it a little bit, too. What's been the reaction in Congress when you've gone to brief Congress? What's been the reaction by the affected agencies, you know, particularly the Department of Justice, that's going to lose the immigration court system under this proposal? What is the immigration court now? You know, we know it's not an Article I court. We know it's not an independent agency court. We know it's not really a traditional administrative law court. What exactly is it, and what are we proposing that it become? So, kind of, what's the receptivity, and you know, what do we have now, and what are we trying to get?
Well, let me start by indicating that there are Article I courts now. For the U.S. Tax Court, for the U.S., in effect, the U.S. Bankruptcy Court, for the U.S. Court of Federal Claims, for the Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. And those are the models we, in fact, looked at and are described in detail in our report. So there are those Article I types of courts. Each one's a little bit different and covers different areas.
And
created by Congress. Exactly. And an Article I court, we're referring to Article I in the Constitution, and so it would have to be created by Congress. This is something that could not be done by the agencies themselves. Similarly, we looked at independent administrative agencies that exist, such as the National Labor Relations Board, the Merit Systems Protection Board, the Occupational Safety and Health Review Commission, which have adjudicatory functions. The immigration courts and the Board of Immigration Appeals are part of the Department of Justice. They're subparts of the Department of Justice. They're subparts of a very big Department of Justice, which is potentially actually one of the problems, is that they sometimes sort of get lost. They're not part of the main functions of the Department of Justice, but you have people who are employees of the Department of Justice, and immigration judges, in effect, are attorney staff of the Department of Justice, but they're adjudicators, and they're making decisions. And the BIA judges are doing the same thing. Karen, maybe you want to address the receptivity to these proposals?
Well, we have been involved in some conversations with agency folks and some people on the Hill, and I can't say very much about the specifics of any of those individual discussions. What I can say is that there is some interest and some discussion about the Article I and the independent agency proposal, and there has been and is continuing to be discussion about comprehensive immigration reform. I haven't seen the two yet coming together. The discussion about structure and independence seems to be different from the CIR discussion and about what immigration policy should be. The CIR discussion is much more about dealing with the undocumented population and about actually what the issues of retroactivity and restoration of discretion. So at least in my own personal involvement, I see them as two separate discussions going on, but I'm unaware that the Schumer bill or any other legislation has any proposals having to do with the structure of the system yet. I encourage anybody to tell me if I'm wrong, but that's my awareness at this point.
I should also mention that there are other groups that have made proposals for Article I courts. For example, the National Association of Immigration Judges has been supporting that for a while. And the Appleseed group recently came out with a proposal for an Article I type court system. Each of the proposals differs somewhat, but they have the same basic idea of an independent court-like system for handling these cases.
And what about the, you know, the judges and the board? What's been their reaction to this kind of analysis, critique, proposal? I mean, I know that they haven't institutionally come out with a position on the ABA report, but kind of, can you tell us off the record or on the record some of the reactions, some of the responses?
Well, of course, all of the immigration judges are prohibited individually from sharing individual views and reactions. So I can only say what I know about the views of the association, the National Association of Immigration Judges, and I don't mean to speak for them, although they have published and spoken on some of these topics. So I can say a little bit about that. It does not include the Board of Immigration Appeals and its views officially or of its members, because they, the board members do not belong to the NAIJ. So what I'm going to say is about the immigration judges only. As you heard, they certainly support as an institution independence from the Department of Justice and have been speaking quite a bit about their need to be viewed as judges and not as attorney adjudicators, to have a code of conduct that relates to pertains more closely to judges than to attorney adjudicators, and the need to have their performance reviewed as judges and not as attorney adjudicators. And they certainly favor the increased resources. The areas where we've been talking about more judges, more law clerks, more time not on the bench, you know, time to deal with motions and research and decision writing and those kind of things. So I think there's widespread agreement on that. I think there are some issues of disagreement with our recommendations where they have to do with hiring criteria, and particularly we haven't gone very far down the road of what grandfathering should be from the current immigration judges to how those judges would be treated if an entirely new system were created, and they have definite views about what should happen to the judges and what the lengths of terms should be and how those appointments should be made. And I can't speak for them, but I think they're either ours may diverge a little bit from theirs, or ours are not as fully developed as their proposals are. That's about as much as I can say on that.
Right. So there are a lot of details that one can differ on and that could be worked out. But I think what we're seeing in recent years is an increasing recognition that the current system, which is a change from the prior system, where INS was sort of a separate entity, and different parts of INS have now been split apart, there's increasing consensus that there are problems with having these courts inside the Department of Justice. You have the politicized hiring of immigration judges. You have the removal of Board of Immigration Judges in 2002, particularly those removal of judges who were viewed as being more favorable to non-citizens were removed. And there's a sense that you can't create the independence that is really needed that affects all these other attributes of professionalism and fairness if it's within the Department of Justice as an entity.
Hi, my name is Tim Vanderveeken from Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Service. I want to thank you for this wonderful, wonderful panel. So much information. Judge Katzmann, you alluded to it briefly, the legal orientation program. I was wondering if you could talk a little more just about how that might expand access to counsel.
The legal orientation program is a program that is being run really directed by Stephen Lang, that's in EOIR. You can get in touch with him there if you want to get involved in that effort. Basically, what the program does is provide for counseling to immigrants, and there are Know Your Rights programs, which are sort of collective programs, there is also a screening program whereby the immigrant's case is screened by non-service providers. Like in New York, it would be, for example, the Legal Aid Society or Human Rights First. Where the case is viewed as a worthy case, legal counsel may be provided at no expense to the government. Immigration courts use this system. For example, the immigration judge may see a case that has some value and refer it to one of these non-service, these non-profit providers. One can imagine an expansion of these programs to include not just detainees, but also non-detainees. And also one can imagine expansion of these programs in terms of more translations in people's languages so that these programs can be more accessible to more people.
Hi, my name is Samson Hobday. I'm a practitioner. I do some immigration practice. And I wanted to ask, sort of following up on some of the questions about the plausibility the political feasibility of some of these reforms. Some are sound a lot more ambitious, the structural changes. But I know a lot of, I don't want to call them small bore stuff, because some of the stuff you were talking about access to counsel and the remoteness of these detention facilities are actually in some pending legislation. I think Senator Leahy has some legislation pending that has a lot of this stuff, and I don't know, maybe I'm unduly pessimistic, but I'm not sure this stuff is going to survive. A lot of these common sense sort of smaller border reforms, and I just don't know. Maybe I don't know enough about how this stuff works, but political feasibility of some of these reforms.
Larry may want to say more about this too, but there is one of the appendices in the executive summary takes all of the recommendations of the report and it breaks them down by whether they could be done right now as a matter of interpretation and policy under the current law, or whether they would need a change to regulations or an actual change to the statute. And I think you're right when you say there are concerns in the current political environment about how far Congress is going to be willing to go with statutory change, how anything from, you know, small individual pieces of legislation all the way up to comprehensive immigration reform. And I wouldn't begin to attempt to predict what's going to happen in that arena. I will say that while we're behind and working to try to encourage reform in all of the areas that we've talked about, including legislation, we are also sort of on a separate track working on trying to encourage the current administration and agency authority to implement, as a matter of interpretation and practice, those things that they could do right now that don't require any change in the law. And all of those things that fall within the ambit of prosecutorial discretion, looking at when an NTA should be issued at all, when there should be more ready agreements to certain forms of relief, the conducting of pretrial conferences, for example, to narrow issues in immigration court, some of the, for example, provision of certain accommodations in immigration court to encourage increased pro bono lawyers until there's any change in interpretation with regarding of the provision of counsel. Those are all some areas that have been identified that don't need a legislative change. So it's kind of a variety of fronts of work happening at the same time. But don't have a good crystal ball to talk about, you know, the legislative stuff at this point. Larry, did you want to say any more about the sort of that breakdown of the categories of recommendations?
Right. Well, that appears in Table ES1 with the 60 recommendations, and each one, as you indicated, is designated as possible under existing laws. For example, right now, video conferencing is used a fair amount, and that creates real problems when you have a merits hearing and you've got you're representing a client and your client is sitting somewhere far away on a TV screen. Are you going to be with your client? Are you going to be where the judge is for that hearing? And that poses great problems. So we recommend limiting use of video conferencing to procedural matters. That's something that could be done today. It doesn't require any legislative activity at all. A number of the recommendations really go to resources, and that's really Congress appropriating more money for more judges, for more law clerks, which would help with a number of problems. And there have been some increases in the budget of the Department of Justice for this, but we think there needs to be more. And that's something that depends upon the political winds at the time.
Carol?
Thank you. Carol Walchuk. I'm a lawyer. Excuse me. It's been a wonderful panel. Thank you all for participating and being so comprehensive with your comments. I've been interested. Judge Katzmann started talking about the quality of lawyering, the lack of representation. I wondered what the impact of any of these proposals would be, the restructuring proposals are, on individuals' ability or necessity of having counsel. Would it increase the cost? Would they increase the cost of having private representation? Would it make pro bono representation less likely because of the time that might be required? And how would they affect an individual's ability to represent themselves in court? I'm thinking about an Article I court with its more rigorous evidentiary rules and so forth, if that would be more difficult for someone to represent themselves. Thanks.
Well, I guess the rules would be what the rules are, and that, you know, remains to be determined. For example, in the Veterans Court, there are rules of procedure, but there are special relaxed rules of procedure for pro se veterans. While, as Larry said, we haven't fleshed out all the details, and our recommendations certainly don't go as far as what rules of procedure could be, guess would be that in a system where, by definition almost, you have even a larger complement of pro se litigants in a system than the veteran system, and in addition, people who frequently have limited proficiency in the English language, my guess would be that regardless of what the rules may be in a practice manual that might pertain to lawyers, that there would be relaxed procedural rules for pro se folks. I can't say that, but that would certainly be my understanding of the way it would work based on what I know about existing systems now that have that aspect.
There's nothing inherent in having an Article I court or an independent agency that requires that there be particular procedures. You could start by thinking, take the existing procedures and move them into an independent body, and you get the benefits of an independent body, of independent judges, not under the Department of Justice. Hopefully you increase the professionalism by attracting even better quality candidates than we have now. But it doesn't necessarily mean that there would necessarily be a higher level of procedures. You could have what you have now. And you could go in either direction, depending upon what makes sense.
I think we should, you know, we have about 5 minutes here, so maybe we should take multiple questions. Why don't we do that, and then we'll answer them all at once. Yep, Kathy.
Kathy Doan with the Capital Area Immigrants Rights Coalition, and again wanted to thank members of the panel for these wonderful comments. One question I had is having to do with the increasing number of individuals who are mentally ill who are coming into the system, and in part that's a direct response to the increasing numbers of folks who are in detention, and being in detention itself can be a factor in somebody's deteriorating mental health. How do you see the proposals that you are suggesting improving due process for individuals with mental illness? Currently, unlike criminal criminal court or other civil court proceedings, there really are no special provisions. Certainly right to counsel is one of those things, but just in terms of other things that you're looking at that would help that situation.
Okay, just a couple more questions. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Megan McKenna with Kids in Need of Defense, KIND. Thank you very much for the very helpful panel. And I'm afraid I haven't read the report yet, but I will. And I'm just curious what recommendations you have regarding children, particularly unaccompanied children.
Okay. Additional questions? Yep.
Sorry, I know that this has sort of been posed before by two other people, but I was wondering if you could have further clarification with regard to things that would be changed legislatively. Do you have any priority? I guess this is really maybe more directed at Mr. Schneider and Ms. Grise. What do you have any particular priority for what you'd be seeking in terms of things that necessitate legislation, such as, for example, some of the stuff like restoring discretion or redefining the parameters, the trigger parameters for aggravated felony, that type of thing, as opposed to a wholesale restructuring of the of EOIR and the which I think Senator Spector had a title in the CIR from several years ago that involved a little bit of that, and a little bit surprised not to have seen any of that resurface, you know, this go round, at least not yet.
I mean, I think, you know, there is Larry was saying, and Karen as well, there's large and small legislative proposals, and there's 60 separate recommendations, and it's listed in an appendix, which would be legislative and which would be administrative, and some of them just involve exercises of discretion, you know. So all of that is totally clear. The two examples that you gave on cancellation, restoration of discretion to judges in certain cases, the aggravated felony rule, I think all of that is in there.
And
retroactivity as well. Of course, you know, an Article I court's going to involve like a, you know, very, very significant legislative action. The two questions on the mentally ill and any recommendations in unaccompanied minors, I think, are similar. So let me, Karen is biting at the bit to answer those. Go.
Yes, and actually, I was going to say I can take them and kill two birds with one stone is probably a bad phrase, but let's try to improve the health of two birds with one stone. We, on the children and mentally ill, the ABA had policy even before the issuance of this report that children and mentally ill should have access to appointed counsel, and that children and mentally ill or mentally incompetent persons should not be forced to represent themselves in removal proceedings as other adults currently are. So we've recommended an expansion of LOP with an intent to triage, and that those two populations should be getting appointed counsel, and that it's inappropriate as a due process matter for the government to be proceeding against people who cannot competently legally represent themselves. There are complicated issues about how that should be done and whether, in addition to having a lawyer still who stands in the shoes of the client, if there is an incompetent person by minority or otherwise, whether there needs to be a GAL who actually makes decisions in the course of the representation. But access to counsel to surface those issues, identify those issues, and take a case forward is one of our leading recommendations. And I failed to say in my opening remarks, one of the cases that I had seen was one in which an immigration judge proceeded against a mentally ill person where she said, well, she was kind of troubled about the obvious confusion in the respondent's mind between himself and the President of the United States. But regardless, he was oriented to place and he understood the nature of the proceedings, so she was finding him competent and going forward. And so the issue there, obviously, even in the other systems that we've talked about, is that you can't have judges making determinations of competency in the absence of any evidence. Not that the person may or may not be competent or the judge may or may not be able to proceed, but the judge can't, without any evidence on the issue, based on their own observations in the court on any given day shouldn't be making those determinations and shouldn't be proceeding. And I would say, needless to say, the ABA position is that the same thing pertains when you have children and particularly layered on indicia of trauma and so forth. So as a pure matter, our recommendation is there should be appointed counsel for those two groups.
And you will see that discussed in the report. And just referring one last time to the table at the end with the 60 recommendations, it also is very handy because it tells you where in the executive summary you'll see a discussion of the point and where in the full report you can see even a fuller discussion, for example, of this point about children and mentally ill.
Okay, it's 11. I think our panelists are going to be around if you want to ask them questions individually, but I wanted to thank them again for giving excellent presentations and for being here with us.
For more information, visit the Migration Policy Institute at www.migrationpolicy.org.